When we talk about the translators, make sure to let people know that they'll need to turn them on if they aren't already on.
Okay.
They're all set to the right channel.
Okay. How are you?
Good. How are you?
We're going to start it up. Just a... All right. If you can have your attention, Sal, Linda, would like to start it. Okay, so good evening, ladies and gentlemen, for our fourth AB 617 meeting in Shafter. Again, my name is Jimmy Yee. I'm the facilitator. There's a couple of housekeeping things that I go over every meeting, but I think by now for some of the general public who haven't been in these meetings, the men's and ladies' room are just off to the left here through the lobby. We've got a full agenda, and we definitely want to get through by 8 o'clock tonight, so we're going to be moving pretty swiftly through the agenda. Couple other points, translation needs. Please make sure you turn on your headsets. They're set to the right channel. And if any of you need assistance, please see our translator. But for committee members and the general public, there are headsets available. In addition, and I think for housekeeping sake, we all know Cynthia, who will be taking copious notes tonight, and Rachel Adino, who's also part of the Southwest Strategy staff, who makes evenings like tonight possible in terms of their logistics and organization. We owe them a big thank you. For those of you who were not here, especially for committee members, there was a change in the way the committee is presenting. And so prior to February, we basically had comment from the public after the conclusion of at the end of the meetings. What is happening moving forward is naturally we want committee input, but we also want the ability to give public comment. And again, we want to limit public comment for 2 minutes on any given subject. But after each presentation, the committee and the public will have an opportunity to present comments and questions. If you haven't signed in, please do. It's important that you stay on our mailing list to be informed of any collateral material that you may need. In addition, we also would like for you to fill out comment cards, especially from the public. And Rachel will basically be facilitating the public comment. So if you have a question after one of the presentations, after the committee speaks, just raise your hand and we'll give you a microphone and make sure that you're recognized and given the appropriate time. Any questions from the committee? No? Great. So a couple other things before we get started. One of the bigger issues is we've had some, and this is really directed at the committee, some comments from the committee members that they would like the committee meetings to start earlier. So I would like to see a show of hands for those of you who would be receptive to having the committee start earlier than 6 o'clock. So if you could just, we don't have decided time just now, but if I could just see a show of hands that you'd be willing to at least meet earlier than 6. Okay, John, Gustavo, great, Sal, Linda. Okay, great. So we agree that maybe an earlier time might work. Is that fair? Okay, so now what we need to do is look at what time would be conducive for the committee members to what would work out? What would work out for you? Maria?
Yeah, go ahead. Está, hay personas
trabajan. So, no sé si podrían estar antes. Because some people working late.
Okay. So we've taken that into consideration. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of working folks, and it's tough to get here. So we want to build a consensus. Could Maria, for those working members, would 5:30 work out? Because there are some people that, you know, it gets...
The same time is good for me.
Okay. Does anyone else have any other thought?
Yeah, sound good.
Earlier?
Okay. No, it's okay.
At 6.
Yeah.
6 is good. 6 is
fine. I'll go up to 6. Sal, Linda... Okay. So, Gustavo?
5:30 wouldn't be the worst, but 6 is fine.
Okay. 5:30? So, can we show if we move the meeting to 5:30 to give those, because some of you want to get home and you have children and you know, other obligations, can I see, would 5:30 work? Can I see a show of hands from the committee? 5:30? Gustavo, great. 5:30? Okay, so we have a consensus. Maria? You want it 6 o'clock?
This time is perfect.
Right.
Because if somebody to my
work.
Friends don't come in on time, they have, ¿cómo se dice? ¿Tiene falta? Y a las 3 faltas nos van a quitar.
And 3 absences then will be out if we don't get here.
Y yo a mí no me gustaría eso.
And I would like to be excluded for 3 absences.
I don't know.
Well, I have to balance the need for, if 30 minutes is seems like a reasonable ask for those of you, you know, who have some obligations after. So, Maria, could we work with 5:30? All right, well, okay, Dora, for those of you who want to keep it at 6, I don't want to spend a lot of time here. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. Just give me 6 o'clock. For those of you who want to keep it. All right, for those of you who want 5:30, you're willing to keep 5:30. Okay. All right. All right. Okay. So moving forward, we'll go 5:30. 5:30. Okay. Is that fair? Okay. So 5:30, Cynthia. So one last thing before we introduce the presenter from the Department of Pesticide Regulation. There is an interactive map. We cannot mail that interactive map. But for those of you in Shafter, especially on the committee, who do not have access to a computer, the Learning Center right around the corner, you can use, and that map is readily available online. So just want to make sure for anyone on the committee, and it's free. So, okay, good. All right. So it's 10 after 6. Why don't we get into the meat of the agenda? And with that, one other thing, too. For those of you who need Wi-Fi, the password is Shafter, lowercase, 49. Again, Shafter 49 for those of you who need Wi-Fi. So let me introduce Randy Sagawa and his partner, Edgar, both from Sacramento, from the Department of Pesticide Regulation. And per the committee's request at our meeting in February, you had asked for, and we had a good dialogue about pesticides in the Shafter community. They have a short presentation, and then we'll open it up for discussion. Okay?
Hours for the Learning Center.
Oh, one other thing. And the hours for the Learning Center are Hang on, Brent.
Hold on.
Monday through Thursday, 8 to 5. Scott's got a BlackBerry here.
No.
I'm just.
Sorry.
Can we just say 8 to 5, Monday through Thursday, and then open on the weekends?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I'll get the hours.
Yeah, Scott will get the hours for those of you who don't have access to a PC. Okay. With that, let me hand it over to Randy with the Department of Pesticide Regulation.
Good evening. As Jimmy said, I'm Randy Sagawa. I'm a special advisor with the California Department of Pesticide Regulation. We call ourselves DPR. We're part of the California Environmental Protection Agency, along with the Air Resources Board and several other boards and departments. DPR is one of three agencies that regulate the sales and use of pesticides in California. So in addition to DPR, US EPA plays a role in pesticide regulation, as well as the Kern County Agricultural Commissioner's Office. So this evening, I'll make a few introductory remarks, turn it over to Edgar Vidrio. Edgar is the manager of DPR's AIR program. Also here this evening to help out if needed is Pam Wofford, who's the manager of the Environmental Monitoring Branch at DPR. Here from the County Agricultural Commissioner's Office is Lynette Bankston. She's the Deputy Commissioner for Pesticides. And then we even brought more backup from our parent agency with Cal EPA. We have Deputy Secretary Julie Henderson, Deputy Secretary for Health and Policy. Is Yana here too? I think Yana, our Assistant Secretary for Environmental Justice. And I see Veronica Eady from Air Resources Board, Deputy Executive Officer for Environmental Justice with ARB. So hopefully between us, we can answer all your questions. Just as introductory remarks, so between the three agencies, EPA, DPR and the Ag Commissioner, we have a comprehensive program to evaluate pesticides, monitor pesticides. If necessary, we develop measures to reduce exposures to pesticides, and then we enforce any restrictions as well. But in the interest of time, for this evening, I know you're particularly interested in air monitoring and whether you should continue or add air monitoring here as part of the program going on at Shafter. So Edgar's going to talk about the air monitoring that's currently going on and what we found, and then we can take it from there. So.
All right. Again, my name is Edgar Vidrio. I am the air program manager. And I know, can everybody see? Oh, there you go. Thank you. Okay, so the outline of today's presentation is I'm going to be talking about the different types of pesticide air monitoring that's available. Then we're going to be kind of giving a brief background of our air monitoring activities here in the community of Shafter. Then I'm going to be talking about some results from that have been measured here in Shafter since our air monitoring began in 2011. Lastly, then Randy will talk about the pesticide air monitoring considerations. So what types of pesticide air monitoring are currently available? There's three types. One is called application site monitoring. This is the type of application. So application type site monitoring occurs near the actual application facility, and it can last for several days. And usually we use that data to assess the maximum exposures occurs over hours or days. Usually we do multiple samples around a field, and we collect either every hour, 2 hours, 8 hour intervals for, again, a period of week or longer. Then we have what we call seasonal monitoring. This is conducted in multiple communities in a high-use area, and that high-use area is defined as relative to other areas. So we looked at pesticide use reports history. We go back of 5-6 years. And then we assess where in the state is the highest use region for a specific pesticide of interest. Then from that, once we have the region that we're interested in that has the highest use, then we select communities based on the location of that community relative to the application. Therefore, we're hopefully targeting the highest use communities in the high use region. And again, this is done for either 1, 2, 3 pesticides, so it's a limited number of pesticides that you can do this for. And then we do this over a period of 8 to 12 weeks. And again, that period coincides with the historical time period where that pesticide has been used. And we use that data to assess maximal exposures over weeks or months. This is what we call the subchronic time period. Usually, again, anywhere from a few weeks all the way to about 3 months or so. Then we have what we call long-term air monitoring. And you guys may be aware of the air monitoring network, which is a example of this long-term air monitoring. Long-term monitoring is a long-term air monitoring project. We usually do it in the communities over multiple years, and we try to assess trends in air concentrations over time. So for the air monitoring network, we sample in communities with, again, high use relative to other communities. And we do it for, we're currently sampling for 31 pesticides in 8 communities throughout the state, Shafter being one of them. We collect a 24-hour sample every week at each location. And then we use that data to assess a maximum exposures for multiple pesticides over the year. So it's more of a long-term exposure monitoring. So why monitor at these communities, specifically at Shafter? So we monitor routinely at various locations throughout the state for multiple pesticides. In 2010, when we were first going to begin the air monitoring network, we assessed over 227 communities, and Shafter ranked 16th among those 227 communities throughout the state. And this was in relation to pesticide use and environmental justice factors. And then in 2016, we reevaluated all 1,267 communities in California that have pesticide use. And again, Shafter ranked 23 out of those 1,267 communities. So because of the high relative use of pesticides, we decided to monitor here in this community since 2011 when we first began the air monitoring network. And again, the main purposes of the monitoring are to assess air concentrations and to determine if any adverse health effects are actually occurring, determine if any of the current requirements are adequate to protect public health, and then if needed, use the data to develop any mitigation measures to reduce those elevated air concentrations. So Shafter here, and I know it's hard to see, I'm sorry. I think you have printouts, so the pictures are a little bit clearer there. But Shafter, we're monitoring in multiple communities in California, Shafter being there. And these are pictures of our new monitoring site that we just launched about 2 weeks ago. And I'll provide a little bit of a background. We recently moved. We were in Shafter High School since 2011. And as of, again, 2 weeks ago, we moved to Sequoia Elementary School. And these are the pictures of the new operational site that we began sampling 2 weeks ago. So this, I wanted to show this. We have two maps in the next two slides. One of them, we are mapping organophosphate, which is a type of pesticide, use in the area. This was maps that we used during our 2016 evaluation of all communities. So the data that we're showing here is pesticide use data from 2012 to 2014, and they're mapped based on what we call a section. It's a 1 by 1 mile square area. See if I have a laser pointer. Yeah. So here, again, this is a 1 by 1 mile area. This area here is the community of Shafter CDP or boundary. Then I'm showing the location of our previous air monitoring network station here. And we've moved a little bit, about a quarter of a mile north to the school, Sequoia Elementary. Now, I don't remember if I have this on the slides, but basically a reason for the move is, we were in Shafter High School since 2011. We were collaborating with the city of Shafter and Shafter High School. We were located at a city well that was non-operational at the time. Because of plans to make that well site operational, they need to do some construction there, so we were asked if we can find an alternative site. Luckily, we work with the Richland School District, and we located a site that's pretty close to our previous site. It's actually, if you look at it, it's actually in a higher, higher use, a little bit higher of the community. This is what we call the windrows, basically showing the direction of the predominant wind. It's showing that wind is coming from the north, northwest down. So basically, this is the direction of the predominant wind. So again, we're closer to that area there. And again, this is organophosphates. The next map that I'm showing, this is the same information, but for fumigants. This is the 1,3-dichloropropenes, methylbromide, chlorpicrin, and methyl isothiocyanate, which are the fumigants that we're monitoring for. Again, same thing, 2012 to 2014 use data. And again, just showing the location of our new sites relative to the historical pesticide use. So in regards to the monitoring that we actually done in Shafter, again, we have over 7 years worth of data. And in that time frame, we've collected an air sample once a week. And in those samples for the 7 years, we've seen the following pesticides in order of frequency. We've seen MITC, which again is methyl isothiocyanate, 1,3-dichloropropene or 1,3-D, methylbromide, chlorpyrifos, EPTC, chlorothalonil, diazinon, DDBP, or dichlorobenzene, iprodione, malathione, orisolin, and then we saw 10 additional pesticides, but we only saw them at a maximum of trace levels. Trace levels simply means that their concentrations are higher than the method detection limit, the analytical detection limit, but they're lower than anything that we can actually quantify. So they're there, we just don't know at what level, since the level is relatively low compared to our analytical method. So really quickly, how do we use the data? How do we evaluate that data that we have? So here we have what we call health screening levels. So DPR developed this health screening levels, which is a concentration that is above the screening level. Any air concentration that is above these levels indicates the need to do a further and more refined evaluation. And then we also have what we call regulatory targets. These are a little more stringent, and basically these are concentrations that are designed to protect against the adverse health effects. Exceeding a regulatory target does not necessarily mean that any adverse health effects has to occur, but it does indicate to the department that we need to do possible additional restrictions on the pesticides maybe need to be modified. And then the evaluation of the monitoring data and computer modeling may lead DPR to develop additional mitigation measures to, again, reduce air concentrations and reduce exposures. So for the last 7 years, we've seen the list of pesticides that I mentioned earlier. So here I'm showing the highest concentration, again, in terms of frequency. And we're showing all air concentration measure each year, so the highest concentration for a 24-hour period or one day, 28-day period, or one-year period. At the end of the table, I have what we're comparing these concentrations to, which is the screening level or regulatory target. And for MITC, for example, we're getting concentrations with the highest concentration of 0.31 parts per billion for one day. That is compared to a target of 220. And then the same thing for the other one. So basically with these values, we compare to the screening levels to see if there's any additional steps that DPR ought to take. Again, MITC, 1,3-D, and methylbromide, all these are fumigants. They're pesticides that are have a high volatility and therefore could get in the air a little more freely, and therefore we do expect to see higher concentrations, which has been the case. And then the next one that I have is, again, the other pesticides that we've seen. We have chlorpyrifos, and I have plus OA. OA means it's an oxygen analog. It's the breakdown product of chlorpyrifos. We are monitoring for both. When we do get the concentrations, we like to put them together to determine a maximum chlorpyrifos concentration. And again, we have the screening levels here, and we have the concentrations for the 1 day, 28 days, and 1 year time periods. One thing I want to point out, and I think we're going to talk a little bit later, I know it's hard to see a table with all these numbers. In our website, we have reports where we evaluate the results. We have a air monitoring results database that has access to every single sample that we've collected over time. So that's all freely downloadable, and I think Randy will talk about it during his portion of the presentation. And here's Randy going to talk about the next few slides.
Yeah, so Edgar talked about the monitoring that we've done through 2017, and we have complete results through 2017. We have partial results for 2018. And early in 2018, we detected a relatively high level of 1,3-dichloropropene, or what we call 1,3-D. Trade name is Telone. We detected 50.5 parts per billion at the Shafter site on January 22nd. At that time, this was the highest 1,3-D concentration we had detected at a community air station going back since the 90s when we began monitoring for 1,3-D. The 50.5 ppb concentration that was detected actually does not exceed our one-day screening level, which is 110 parts per billion. And so we're still below that. But when we average that one sample with the other sample over another 90-day period, then we do exceed our screening level for the 90-day period, which is what we call our seasonal or subchronic level. And so since now we have exceeded our screening level for 1,3-D, that triggers some additional evaluation by DPR. And so based on information from the County Agricultural Commissioner, we believe that that detection, the 50.5 ppb, was due to a single application the day before the monitoring started. That application occurred a few hundred feet north of where the sampling site is. And we think that's what caused the high air concentration that we were detecting. So based on this information, DPR is doing a more detailed evaluation, and we're also evaluating possible additional measures to reduce exposures. Some other air monitorings, other than what Edgar had just talked about, that one single monitoring station in Shafter, the Air Resources Board, at DPR's request, also conducted one of those seasonal studies in the area. This was a study for organophosphate. So again, it's chlorpyrifos, as well as malathion, diazinon, and some other pesticides within the same group. Air Resources Board conducted that monitoring in 2018 for a 10-week period at several communities in Kern County, including Shafter. And the site in Shafter was at the DMV site where the Air District currently has their monitoring station. So the objective for this monitoring, again, is to estimate the seasonal exposure for this group of organophosphate pesticides. So for each of the 10 weeks of monitoring, there are four consecutive 24-hour samples collected for a 10-week period during the high use season of March through May. CARB actually has just finalized the report. They just emailed it to us this afternoon. We haven't had a chance to get a close look at it, probably in a couple of weeks, we will have it posted to our website. Okay. You can't read this. your handout's probably hopefully a little clearer. This is a screenshot of DPR's online database for our air monitoring results. So you can go to this website and then look up any specific sample we have or any group of samples we have. So if you want to see all the samples collected at Shafter since 2011, you can do that here. If you're only interested in 2013, you can pull up all the 2013 results. If you're only interested in chlorpyrifos, you can filter so you just see the chlorpyrifos results. And so it gives you an opportunity to take a closer look at the data that we have. Moving forward as to whether or not the pesticide monitoring and Shafter should be expanded, a few things to be aware of. The sampling and monitoring that we've been talking about is quite complex, very labor intensive. We have to collect a sample and then send it to a laboratory for analysis. There is no, quote, real-time air monitor for pesticides. That is where you place an instrument and it reads out what the air concentrations are. There's no such instrument available. And so we have to collect a sample and send it to a laboratory for analysis. That normally takes 2 to 4 months to collect the sample, get it back from the lab, analyze the data, and see what's going on. And it's very expensive. The site we're maintaining at Shafter costs approximately $150,000 per year for the suite of 31 pesticides that we're monitoring for. Okay, and I think, yeah, the last slide is just a more detailed cost breakdown of how much the monitoring costs. And with that, I will stop and see if there are questions or comments.
So hang on. Thank you, Randy and Edgar. They're not going anywhere. So what we'd like to do now is just work the committee, and so everyone has an equal opportunity to ask any questions. And so we'll start here. Do you need some time to? We can come back to you. Antonio. Maria?
Mi pregunta es, ¿qué hubiera pasado si no estuviéramos aquí mirando esto? ¿Cuánta gente antes ni siquiera se imagina de lo que ha muerto? Ni que sus niños están en la escuela respirando las fumigaciones. Me siento muy mal por eso. He visto niños en la escuela Sagoya a las 4 de la tarde o 3 de la tarde jugando afuera y las avionetas fumigando encima de los niños. Gracias a esto, ¿se le puede dar una información a los padres? Que muchas de las veces llevan a sus hijos al doctor y no saben ni de qué están enfermos. Pienso que puede más lo monetario que lo humano. Es triste. Es todo lo que puedo decir.
Socorro. Gustavo.
Sure. Going back to the second slide, the types of pesticide air monitoring, you have application on site, seasonal, and long term. Out of those air monitor or those monitoring practices, how is that information disseminated to the residents of Shafter, like the surrounding areas, right? Other than blasting them on your webpage, like how are actual folks here like retrieving that information or consuming that information?
Well, up until recently, so the only monitoring that's been occurring is the long-term air monitoring network at the Shafter site. And we've been working through the school to disseminate that information.
Like the school districts, like through the parents?
So for every monitoring location that we have, especially for the air monitoring network, we go back to the site operator. In this case, most of them are in public schools, and we create what's called a fact sheet, which has kind of a summary of the results for that year and then also trend analysis for the whole time that we've been doing. So they're able to disseminate that information to the group, to the area, to kids, to the parents, however they see fit. Additionally, we also have presentations that we try to do with the different communities. Sacramento headquarters, we have scientific interviews that presentations that we do. And then we also come in and try to do outreach events. Now, going forward, one of the efforts is to actually increase that presence that we have to, again, to kind of relay that information for you. Also, our website, we have contact information there that people are able to contact us with any questions that they have, and we'll try to send the results of the monitoring to them.
Okay. Thank you, man. And moving on to like the evaluation of the air monitoring data, kind of still within this, like it says here, the DPR regulatory target concentration. Is there a baseline in Shafter for like all the different? You said that you guys displayed all the, what is it, the top, I don't know, like list of pesticides that have been triggered or collected here, like
detected.
What is the baseline for that? Like above what level, like do folks know it's dangerous or, you know? And how is that baseline being communicated?
Yeah, so that goes back to the results themselves. And so here, these are the highest concentrations we detected in any year. Compared to, on the far right column, is the screening level or regulatory target. And so ideally, the concentrations that we're detecting would be less than our screening level or regulatory target. And in this case, all the way up through 2017, that was the case. And then this last sample that we collected in January 2018, that was the first one where it actually exceeded the screening level.
Okay, and that was for, is that for the Tolone? Is that what you're referring
to? Correct, yes.
And so in 1990, there was a register of Tolone in this general area that was lower than the concentration that was just received in 2018. And at that instant, it was banned for 5 years, that practice of injecting, you know, this Tolone product. Like, what action will be taken this time around when the concentrations were higher?
So we're still evaluating the options, what measures we should take to further reduce the concentrations. Now, I will say that back in 1990 was some of the earliest monitoring that we've done. At that time, we had few restrictions in place. And at that time, we weren't sure exactly how to change the applications to reduce the exposures. Since 28 years from now, we have a much better idea of what's going on and how to reduce exposures.
Cool. And I think that might be it. Yeah, I think that's it for now.
I have a question. You said you notified some of the residents through the school with the children of the concentrations. So what about the rest of us? I mean, have you had public hearings or public meetings here in Shafter? Or can you send out public-wide report like they do with the water, indicating the measures or what are the contaminants in the water? I mean, have you taken any of those measures?
That's something we could consider. We, of course, don't have everybody's address, but we could work possibly with some local agencies to help us with that.
Okay, another question I have is, how would you monitor? I know you say you have a monitor over here at Sequoia. but how do you monitor the concentrations around communities like in outlying communities like where we live? We are surrounded by three orchards and they crop dust. We get it all over. Our children get it. I mean, how do you measure that?
At this point, we only have 8 stations deployed statewide looking for the full suite of 31 pesticides. And we've picked those 8 sites because we think that they will have the highest concentrations because they're located in what we think are going to be the highest use areas. And so we think that other locations will have lower concentrations than what we're monitoring here in Shafter.
So if there are other types of monitors in our area or in other outlying areas, would you consider the reports from those or and what you could do? Or?
I'm sorry, I don't think I quite understood the question.
Okay. If there are other individual monitors in our areas, and I don't know what kind they are, but if you would have reports from those and they indicate high concentrations of whatever it is, what steps would you take to monitor that or curtail those concentrations?
Okay, yeah. We're not aware of any other monitoring going on, but if there were monitoring and if the data were submitted to DPR, we would definitely take a look at it. If it did show high concentration, if we did exceed a screening level or regulatory target, then it would cause us to consider additional reduction measures.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, pass. just a couple of questions. I think I feel somewhat fortunate that we're one of the 8. But would you expect other agricultural areas in the – you said that Shafter would be higher. Would you expect other agricultural areas to be similar to Shafter, or are we unusual?
I don't know that you're unusual. In fact, when we Edgar talked about evaluating 1,267 communities, and what we found is that in any one region, there were a number of communities that were ranked similarly. And so, for instance, here in Shafter, my guess is you're ranked similar to Wasco and the other communities within the same area.
Wasco or Delano or McFarland.
Exactly.
This isn't necessarily, I mean, it would be representative, I guess.
Presumably, yes.
Okay. And then I did have one specific question about the 50 parts per billion that you noticed up at the high school in 18. Or was that at the high school or was that at Sequoia?
That was at the high school, yeah.
And you said that the there had been an application just a few hundred feet north of there. A few hundred feet north of that site is still the high school.
And so I think it was, about 700 feet north of the monitoring station.
So it was a little bit further than that. It was off the high school, off the high school property.
It was at an orchard.
Yeah. Okay.
What would be planted to an orchard.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The monitor was at the high school. They gave you permission in 2010, right? The high school district.
Yes.
And then when did the city ask you to take the monitor away?
We've been monitoring since 2011. We've been meeting with the city and the school almost on a yearly basis since the monitoring began, just kind of, you know, talk about the monitoring, how it's going. And they have talked to us about the eventual reconstruction in the area to get the well back up. So we had pretty some warning. The timing wasn't there. We didn't know exactly when it was going to be. Now, the last time we met with them, they already had some actual timing in mind. So that's when we started looking at the other possibilities, and we luckily found Sequoia. And I believe that was 2017,
yes.
Late 2017, correct? Yeah.
Okay, so you had plenty of time to get the elementary district to give you permission.
And get the site up and running. So we didn't touch upon that, but to get a site ready, especially for the air monitoring equipment that we have, you need several things, including electrical, fencing, security. You need to buy all the equipment. So that gave us enough time to get the site at Sequoia up and running.
Okay. And then since the first detection of Talon or 1,3-D, was 50.5, and the average was 5.6 for 90 days. That's a pretty high average. So I'm assuming the next week, because you're sampling every week, but random days?
Yes. Yeah, we randomize the sampling. It's every week, and it's randomized throughout the year. So it can be as close as, 2 days apart if it straddles the Saturday-Sunday period, with Sundays when the new bingi begins, or it can be as far as, I believe, 12 days apart.
So the second sample, do you have the date for that? Because the first one's the 22nd.
Right. I don't have it in front of me, but everything will be basically on that database where you have access to all the individual samples. But I think what you're getting at, if I understand you correctly, is the concentrations for the week. So we had a 50.5 concentration on that week. The following week, it was lower. It was in, I can't remember the number, but in the teens. And then it fell the following week. And that's how you get basically the averages. You basically aggregate, again, in this case, it's 90 days, and then that's how the 5.6 came out. So some of them are higher, some of them are lower, but none of them are near the 50.5 level.
Okay. And when was the regulatory target raised to 110? Because I understood it was quite a bit lower than that. What year was it raised?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
The regulatory target of 110, it was not always 110.
I understand it
had been lower.
No, it's always been 110. No, okay. The cancer risk target, the 0.56, that has changed. But the 110, that's always been the same since we've started.
.56?
Yes. That's the 70-year target for lifetime cancer risk.
Okay, so I've lived here 70 years, so. Is that a percentage? I have a 50% chance of getting cancer?
At the .24, no. You're much less than 5%.
Oh, at the .24.
Yeah, .24.
Oh, okay. So just a smaller chance. Okay. So the 0.56 was raised from what lower level, though? What had it been?
Yeah, it used to be 0.14.
0.14.
0.14. And then we did another or updated our evaluation of the toxicity for 1,3-D. And based on new data, new evaluation, that's where we changed from the 0.14 to the 0.56.
What year was that?
That was in 2015.
Oh, very recently. So,
yeah.
So I had in 2015, I had a much greater chance of getting cancer, over 100%. Okay. So seems like you should have taken a stronger action on Talone after reading that 50.5. I mean, did everybody scramble to decide what to do right away?
We're still working on it, actually.
Mm. So a couple more years, you might decide if Talone should be banned or not?
We've been working on it for about 6 months now.
Yeah. Okay, I'll stop there.
I had a question on that 50.5 as well. So forgive my non-knowledge of pesticides. Since this is so far over, does the person that applied this, is there a fine to them? How is this regulated?
Well, again, so we did not exceed our acute screening level of the 110. So the 50.5 is less than the 110 PV acute target. Now, again, we did exceed our screening level for the 90-day period, but exceedance of the screening level is a trigger for DPR to do a more in-depth evaluation.
Okay. I had another question because I've noticed that sometimes there's air application and sometimes there's land application. Obviously, the air application pushes down into the ground, and then the ground application, I see it going up into the air. Is there one that you can say, if we have to have these, would be better for our environment than the other? I mean, for the air we breathe, because I can go outside and I can smell it.
Sure, yeah. So different pesticides and different crops will have different methods of application. Some are applied by aircraft, others by, it sounds like what you're describing, is what we call an air blast sprayer for orchards. And certainly a well-done aerial application could have lower drift than a bad air blast application. But it could also be the opposite. So it's really going to be on a case-by-case basis. That said, much of the focus for us, and sounds like for you, has been on 1,3-D. And 1,3-D is what we call a fumigant. It's a pesticide that turns into gas readily. And so it's not sprayed or applied by aircraft. It's only injected into the soil.
Do you think in the future, kind of going by what they were asking, if the Air Board has an app that they've given us for air quality levels, do you think for a place like us that is there a possibility that we would have an app, especially by the schools,
right,
to whether it's okay for the kids to go outside or not?
Yeah, you know, nothing in the short term, because like I said earlier, there is no real-time monitor available, unlike for ozone, where ARB or the district can set up an instrument and you see the readout immediately as to what the ozone air concentration. We don't have that for any of the pesticides, unfortunately. So we only find out what the air concentration is several months after we collect the sample. And that's just a limitation of the technology at this point.
Thank you.
So is there time of day, hours, or whatnot, where you see the spike in the pesticide, or is that just that 24-hour period? So over that 24 hours, that's what the sample that was accumulated?
Right. And so for our error network, we are collecting samples for a 24-hour period. Edgar had mentioned earlier, we also conduct what we call application site monitoring, where we place monitors right next to a field. And in that case, we do run shorter periods. We normally run, for instance, like 6-hour periods at the beginning. And we do find that air concentrations will change over time of day.
And so he mentioned wind direction. Are those set up in that wind direction?
Yeah, and so what we end up doing is when we do monitor an application site, we set up samplers surrounding the field. So no matter what the wind direction is, we'll capture it.
Okay, and was there any thought maybe around when spraying does occur? What could be away from peak hours from school and whatnot? So I think she mentioned if it's safe for kids to go out, but if some type of spraying was done on a weekend where there is no children, it may be, you know, better for them.
Yeah, and that's something we can consider both at the state level as well as the local county level. That said, we now have a regulation in place to provide additional protections for applications near schools. And so if the application is what we might consider a high drift potential, such as by aircraft or air blast sprayer, then there has to be a quarter mile distance between that application and the school Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. So that does force them to only apply those pesticides near schools on weekends or holidays then.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I think just one question. The going back to that table, screening level or regulatory target. So that's to account for the 0.56 70-year average. All the rest are screening levels?
In the case of 1,3-D, yes, that's the case.
Okay. And how about the other ones? Those are all screening levels as well?
For the MITC, the one-day 220, that's a regulatory target. The other two, the 28-day and the one-year, those are screening levels.
Okay. So what might be helpful for me, anyway, I mean, I can go home and do it, but for the group would be a version of this that shows what percentage of the screening target those maximum observations were, so that we know what we're talking about. I mean, just scanning across there, 0.31 is what percentage,
of the
screening
level.
And that might be more meaningful than just seeing raw numbers.
Right.
Saying, well, we were, even with the 0.57, the maximum 1-2-3-D in 2013, we're still just over a quarter of the screening level.
Right.
So not that I want to breathe any 1-2-3-D when I'm outside, but we're still a quarter below even where you get interested in tracking down the source.
True, yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, if you go to our website, which I'm sure you're anxious to, read our annual reports actually do that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have quite a few questions. For the third slide, where the types of air monitoring, for the seasonal, you said that you monitor one or two pesticides conducted by a period. What if there's pesticides that are combined? Let's say if they do combinations, like the grower actually does a couple at the same time, does it pick up the one that you're actually trying to read, or does it just not work because there's multiple?
Yeah, in general, the laboratory will not detect it because since we have to send the sample back to the laboratory, for any one sample, there's only a limited number of pesticides that they can analyze for in that particular sample. To get a whole bunch of pesticides, we have to collect other samples. So, for instance, in our air network, where we're looking for 31 pesticides, to monitor all 31, we actually have to collect 4 samples simultaneously to get all 31 pesticides. And so for a seasonal study, we're focused really on one or two pesticides that have high use in that region at that time of year. While we may detect other pesticides, chances are it's not going to be the peak region or the peak season. And so we probably want to do a separate study in order to find that other pesticide.
No, my question is, if there's a mixture, let's say if they do an aircraft application, if they mix certain pesticide, like chlorpyrifos or something like that, if they mix it with different types of pesticide, would it also read that? Would it read the chlorpyrifos, yes or no?
Yes, it would. Yes, okay. I'm sorry. Yes, I didn't understand the question. Okay. Yes.
And how long does it take to put it in the public for the seasonal?
Usually from the time the sample is collected until the report is produced, generally about 1 year.
1 year?
Yeah.
Okay. You were talking about 2018 having the TLON. Is there any possibilities that you could log in so we could see the recent data that was given for all the pesticides that were reading?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, the answer is no. Usually we post reports that are finalized on our website or our database. With that said, though, anytime we have a high concentration that requires that level of analysis, we want to notify our scientific advisory committee that we have at DPR, as well as the public in these meetings. So, for example, the 50.5, that hasn't been included in a report yet because we're working on 2018 right now. That report will be available this summer. But we talked about this concentration last year because it was a high concentration that we saw, again, 2 to 4 months after the fact. So the next time that we had a meeting, these meetings are scheduled every other month, we brought it up to the attention of our scientific advisory committee as well as to the public to let it know that, hey, we saw a high detection. We're doing an additional in-depth evaluation, and this is what we know so far. So in those cases where we have high detections, we do want to make it publicly available as soon as possible. But then you also need some context. So again, that question that was asked earlier about the what happened the week after that, what happened the week before, that is in the report where we actually look at trend analysis. We look at what is the different concentrations. So the reports are always going to be more thorough and they're going to have more data, but we do mention these concentrations at the earliest possibility that we have.
What kind of violations do you do if there's high readings like that?
When we detect a high concentration, we do discuss it with the county ag commissioner, and the county ag commissioner may or may not have information to follow up on. For instance, they can definitely check the pesticide use reports that are required and things like that and check the paperwork. They only do on-site inspections for a percentage of all applications. And so they may or may not done an inspection for the application that resulted in a high concentration.
So it's only on the discretion of the Ag Commissioner to do some type of violation if it was necessary?
If they find a violation, then they will take action, yeah.
But you're saying that it's only on the discretion of the Ag Commissioner to do to check it out?
Yes.
So it's not mandatory, even though it's affecting the public?
No, but again, remember, we did not exceed our acute screening level. Okay. Yeah, please, Lynette. This is Lynette Bangston, Deputy Ag Commissioner for Kern County.
My name's Lynette. I'm with the Kern County Ag Department, and I'm over the pesticide use enforcement division. So when this happened, actually DPR did alert us, and part of our response is we do enforce all existing pesticide laws and regulations and any permit conditions or any other ordinances that are in effect. So when we were alerted to this application, we did look into it. You got to remember it was months afterwards, though. So it's not that we can go out there and see what was actually going on because it had already occurred. We do inspections, but we can't be everywhere all the time. And on this specific application, they had appropriately given us notice because they have to give us 48-hour notice of application. And so we had seen the rates and the recommendation and everything looked okay. The buffer zones were all met. So we did do an investigation and we found that everything was met except there was a new school regulation that had gone to an effect on January 1st of 2018. Mm-hmm. So you got to remember this application that we found because of DPR alerting us, it had occurred, I believe, but January 21st was the application. There was a new regulation that went in effect January 1st that filled fumigations, which was what this was with Talone. Are within a quarter mile of a school site, they must be completed at least 36 hours before the start of classes. So that's a new regulation that had gone into effect on the 1st of January of 2018. And we found during our investigation, because we go out and do inspections and talk to the applicators and do a records inspection on all their documents, and we found that they had completed it 16 hours before the school went into session. So not to say that that's what caused the spike, because that's not, we weren't there, we don't know, but we did find that there was a violation and we went ahead and went forward with enforcement action on that. So we do a notice of proposed action, and so that was for violating that not completing it, giving that 36-hour completion time. And I don't know what the specific fine amount was, but we fined them a monetary fine. And that goes into their record, so. Okay.
Is that public record if that case is closed?
Yes, once if they can ask for a hearing if they don't agree, and there's an appeal process called, it's all due process. But that case, I believe, is closed. Did pay, and so it's closed at this time. So, yes, it's public information at that point. So you can always come to our office at the Ag Department and request it, do a public request, and we could give you that.
Okay. Another question, how to reduce the impacts of after that reading was done? What is your next second step after?
Yeah, so we're currently looking at our various options to further reduce the exposures.
You were talking about the school regulation that came into place last year, but you were talking about there's a time limit for pesticide application, and it's from 6 o'clock in the afternoon to 6 o'clock in the morning. How about kids that play sports that have to practice in the afternoons? Are they also being protected, or is it just the discretion of the grower to apply their product in their field?
Yeah. To handle the extracurricular and other activities at a school, the regulations provide an option for a three-party agreement between the grower, the school, and the county ag commissioner to add in additional restrictions for those occasions.
But it's just the discretion of the ag commission.
Yeah, correct.
So at this point, you're telling us that our kids are not being protective if they play sports, if these fumigants or pesticides applied?
The school regulation is only in addition to what was currently in effect. And the additional or the other requirements provide what we think is adequate protection for schools. For instance, a grower cannot just apply pesticides when he sees children next door. The current regulations, other regulations, require him to stop that application if somebody might be affected.
So it's only if they see people or children in the playground that they could stop?
They're required to stop.
They're required to stop. Well, how about for the children that start off as early as 5 in the morning?
Same thing. And so the other requirements that are in effect have no time restrictions. So matter when children are there, if they will be exposed to the pesticides, the grower cannot make the application.
And for the residents that live there?
Same thing.
You can't tell somebody to not go outside in the hot summer that are trying to be out. Have a good time outside, and they're applying pesticides outside. Is there any notification for the people that live around the fields?
Generally, there's no notification. But again, the grower would not be allowed to make the application if there are people nearby.
Okay, another question. For the monitors for the pesticide, is there any days that have been off, like for maintenance or anything like that?
So our monitors are a little bit different than, again, like Randy mentioned, the ozone, and that they're on the whole time. Ours, they're manually operated. Every week, there's a physical person goes to the actual site, turns them on, begins the monitoring process, and then 24 hours later, they come back, get the sample, turn it back off. So they're off most of the time because you actually have to collect the physical sample. It can be real-time monitoring. Now, when there's malfunctions, let's say the equipment fails, the pump stopped midway, then we do what is called a makeup sample. We actually have a week to collect. We want to make sure we get the week. I'm sorry. I think I pressed something. We want to make sure we get the week. So if a sample fails one day, we try to collect it the next day. And if it fails again, then we do it again. In this side, for example, Shafter, we actually have the primary sampling equipment. And then on top of that, we actually have backup equipment in case that happens so that we get at least one 24-hour sample during that week. If it requires us to come 5 days straight to get the sample, then we do that. Now, there's cases where we're going to sample on Saturday, and that's the end of the week, and then Sunday is the next week, and we lose a sample. Then, yes, we've lost samples before. That is basically said on our reports, invalid samples, number of samples, and the reason why. Equipment malfunction because of transportation issues. But yes, that all of that is on our website and the reports. But most of the time, we do make up a sample because we have the time.
And how far is the reading from the monitor?
The monitoring is doing the reading at the monitor, at the inlet.
Station,
it's actually sucking the air in.
How long it has to be sucked in? The air has to be sucked in?
We're doing ambient air monitoring. That basically what that means is whatever's in the air when the when the pump is actually pulling their air in. Now, where that air comes from, it all depends on obviously wind conditions, the volatility of the chemical in the air. It can move from a few feet to a few hundred feet. It all depends on the conditions.
Mostly to do with that last question that she had, which was because I noticed that one of the, sorry, is that better? Oh, yes? Okay. Because I noticed that the closest monitors you had said were about a quarter mile for each, you said it was about a mile of per square? Is that enough? And just how effective is it?
We do think that the one monitor is enough for our purposes. DPR's done at least two other studies in other communities in previous years where we've had multiple monitors in a single community. And what we found is that at least on a long-term basis, there's very little difference between those different stations. And so for that reason, we think it's better for us to only have one sample and one monitor in each community and maximize the number of communities we're monitoring.
Right. And the other one is earlier when you were mentioning that there were other sites for measuring higher concentrations, not within city limits, and what difference would it make? I had it all organized a certain way. You said that there were eight sites, but where are they, and what difference would it make to measure the sites that have higher concentration in regards to the lower concentration? Shouldn't they all be treated the same?
To answer the first part, so you probably can't see it. This is the map that shows the stations currently in operation. Can you?
So like these are long-term air monitoring sites. These are the ones that were taking a sample a week for over a year. And currently, if I could do them all, it's Watsonville, Chular, Santa Maria, Oxnard or Camarillo, Cuyama, Shafter, Lindsay, San Joaquin, and then we have another study that we do as part of the DPR where we look for T-Lone, again, for a long-term basis, and that one is in Delhi and Parlier. If I understand your second question, we try to get as many sites available in the highest use regions. Then we don't actually mix the sites. We don't actually, if I understand correctly, you mentioned about what difference between the high and the low or what do we use it for. Here we're looking at see what is the maximum concentrations for that pesticide in that region. And that is put into the database that we have. That data is used for other purposes like risk assessments and so forth. So all that data, regardless of the levels, is actually analyzed by DPR. And if we need any mitigations, that is kind of it's used.
Okay. I probably had some other things, but for now, I guess that was just it. Was this again?
Can I ask just one more question? Do you see a lot of difference for kilo between Parlier and here?
Hang on, John. Excuse me, Randy.
Do you see any similarities between Parlier and here, or are those numbers vastly different?
They're similar. We're also detecting high concentrations in Parlier.
My question is: are there any application protections for us who live around the orchards? Is there a buffer zone? And if not, what kind of recourse do we have if they don't follow whatever regulations you have?
different pesticides would have different requirements. The only statewide requirements we have for pesticides other than the fumigants would be chlorpyrifos. I'm not sure if you have any local requirements.
Yeah, they run right along the road. It's right across the street, and so everything filters into our community. I mean, is there? So you say there are no regulations just to stay within the field?
There are regulations, and there's also the pesticide label. Like you said, each one has a different requirement of distance. So if someone believes it is drifting onto them or their property or their vehicle, that's where they would contact us because we have to have proof to show it went off site. So we can sample, but we have to be notified so we can get out to the location to prove that it went off site. So that's where you would contact our department.
Okay, and then usually how long does it take to respond? Okay, thank you.
And I have, I want to make this very clear that, so the reading that was on 123D or the Talone that was registered high in you guys' air monitoring project, it was not an isolated incident, right? Like, what's the frequency of Talone applications that happen? You know, like Dora said, fence line to communities, like what, and taking advantage that the Kern County Ag Commissioner's office is here, like what is the frequency? How often are these loan applications happening in these communities?
Well, I'm sorry, I don't know offhand. It's something we could look up, but I just don't know offhand.
So for Talone, they're applied seasonally more often than other times, depending on the crop season, you know. So there are certain times that they're used more than others. That's all I can say. I don't know the number of applications that we do, but it's not uncommon. Field fumigations are used pre-plant to planting carrots, potatoes, other crops, so...
I don't think that got mentioned, but I just want to make all of you guys aware that DPR has a pesticide use report information that has every application or records of every application. So you can go to the website and actually type in whatever pesticide you're looking for, and then the county, and then it will give you a record of that of those applications. Obviously, the way it works is I believe we're in 2017 now or 2016. So they're a little bit delayed, that's just how the process works, but it will give you an actual record of every application.
Getting back to the cancer risk level for Talone of 0.56, which you raised from 0.14 in 2015, I understand that the State Department of Environmental Health, OEHA, recommended you not raise that level. Why did they say that?
Difference of scientific opinion.
Okay, and I understand that. Is this level set for a small baby, a teenager, an adult, or just someone who lives 70 years?
Yeah, so it's based on a 70-year exposure. Yeah.
But you would agree that if a small baby was exposed, they would be more susceptible, right? Just in general.
For cancer risk, I'm not sure, frankly. I don't know. Normally, you're not going to get cancer after a single exposure. Normally, it requires repeated exposures over several years.
Well, I'm just thinking of a child whose body is growing very rapidly. The environmental toxins can perhaps do more danger.
Yeah. Well, we in our assessment of the potential health risk, we do account for the different age groups. And so we look at exposures from infants all the way through 70 years. And so we do account for differences in respiration and body weight of infants versus adults, if that answers the question.
And I've been told, I haven't read it, that EPA says that exposure to 1,3-D among small children, like 2 years old, is not safe at any measurable level. Have you heard that?
I have not heard that. In fact, last time I was aware of EPA's assessment, they did not think it caused cancer.
Okay, I'll have to check that.
I have another question over here. Okay. If chlorpyrifos is going through the air toxic contaminant process and has their long-term effect and short-term effects, how are you reading chlorpyrifos, as seasonal or long-term?
Both.
Both?
Yeah. So in the case of chlorpyrifos, we actually have all three types of monitoring. So we have monitoring data for specific application sites. We have seasonal monitoring data, and we have our long-term air monitoring network data.
Have you compared the three monitors reading?
Yes, and so based on all the data we have, we do think that the acute or short-term exposures are of the most concern.
But you still haven't alerted the public about it?
Just because they're concerned doesn't mean we've actually exceeded any of our screening levels yet. So we're considering additional restrictions for chlorpyrifos at this time.
But it won't be mandatory for the Ag Commission or so for to being used, or
right now,
like
we
like the old recommendations you did. It wasn't mandatory.
So
it was a requirement.
Yeah. So DPR has issued some recommended restrictions for chlorpyrifos. We did that at the beginning of the year. And to my knowledge, Kern County has implemented all of those recommendations. And Lynette's saying, yes, they have. And so those restrictions, once the county requires them, they are required. And so if you make an application that does not comply with the county requirements, that's an illegal application. Those are interim measures. DPR is now working on some permanent restrictions to apply statewide.
Okay.
Do you foresee in the future that with all this knowledge that we can start alerting residents to what might be sprayed around them? So you would have the opportunity to possibly leave if you have a child that might have asthma or something. I mean, we have all these studies that you've done, but unless I was here, I would never know this. I mean, is there any way that we can get this out into the community?
A notification system is an idea that has been brought up before. Under the previous administration, they did not think that it was feasible. The new administration may be reconsidering that.
Like an app?
Statewide, there are thousands of pesticide applications that occur every day. Mm-hmm. And so developing an app, it would not be an easy task. Complaints. Yes, yes. And so,
can they use a baseline to notify residents?
No, that's backing up. So, DPR is developing an app to make it easier to submit complaints to the County Ag Commission when somebody's out and notices a pesticide application near a school that shouldn't occur. They can use this app to submit that incident report. But to provide notification, it has to go the other way. And so, again, that's more complicated.
There,
because we don't have your phone number. So again, it would require providing notifications for thousands of applications every day. So how do we know which one you're interested in? Like I said, it would have to be a complicated system.
Okay, what if we went the other way? And how many pesticide sprayers do we have in this area? Can they put something on their website to notify public? Can we go the other way where it's not of what they might be spraying in what area to give us a chance to get out of there? Can we work? If we can't do the app, if it's too many people, too many pesticides, could the pesticide companies themselves, because they know what they're going to spray, they know when they're going to spray it. I'm assuming they have to talk to someone to spray it.
Yeah.
The farmer knows. I mean, can we have some type of make them a little bit more accountable so we have the chance to leave?
I don't want to seem to be blowing you off, but I suggest we discuss this issue at a future meeting. For one thing, Kern County has had a pilot project on notification, but I'm sure Lynette is not prepared to explain or answer questions about that pilot project. But I think at a future meeting, somebody from the county can come in, explain this pilot project on pesticide notification that they have, what issues have come up, how successful it's been, and build from there.
Okay. Gustavo.
And I don't know if it's a transitional question, but so we got some pretty good knowledge and feedback on pesticides. How do we integrate this into 617? Like, what's the next steps?
That's, as I understand, that's kind of up to you to make suggestions.
Cool, yes. Let's do it.
¿Tienes pregunta, Ana?
Si esto es, esto se está nivelando a un futuro o a largo plazo, nosotros aquí como residentes nos damos cuenta cuánta gente se está muriendo de cáncer aquí en Shafter. Cada persona, nomás hay una iglesia católica, yo no sé de las demás iglesias católicas. Pero cada dos semanas o cada mes, las personas que mueren, mueren de cáncer. Y esto es como una caja de Pandora, porque ahorita se está abriendo, pero no hay conciencia de cuántas personas ya han muerto de cáncer, incluyendo niños. ¿Por qué? Porque no se dice. No se dice nada. Nomás es cáncer, una bacteria, un virus, esposas, hijos, vecinos, están muriendo de cáncer. ¿Cuántas más tienen que morir para abrirnos los ojos de que esto es una bomba de contaminantes? No entiendo yo.
Tom.
So besides long-term exposure causing cancer, what is the short-term exposure symptoms in terms of illness or damage to the body?
That's going to vary from pesticide to pesticide.
For 1,3-D.
Oh, for 1,3-D?
Because you were above the exposure level for 90 days just a year ago.
So it's a decrease in body weight.
Okay, and online it says it can cause liver and kidney damage. Does that happen pretty quick?
I'm not sure.
So I recommend that we're only a little over a year later, that you do a survey of the students at Sequoia and the students at the high school, and the people living in between that segment of Shafter to see if any illnesses came up above normal levels that could be related to this. It's not proof, but it seems like if you had this serious exposure and that you're thinking about what to do about it, why don't we check for the effects of that exposure last year and see if anything pops up? It's just a survey, right? You go to the health department, you get whatever data they have, and you do a personal survey. I think it's worth it.
Okay, so Tom, thank you for that closing statement. Let me just go around. My assumption is that the committee does not have any more questions, but I kind of want to take this one step further. Are there action items that are currently need to be discussed that Cynthia can put down and we can report back to you at our meeting in April? Oh, I'm sorry, Angelica, you have some more questions for Randy or Edgar? Any actionable items that you folks have seen regarding tonight's discussion? Gustavo. And then we'll get to the public here in a minute.
So one possible action item that I could think, that I could foresee coming up is how the 24-hour sampling methodology and equipment could be integrated into the overarching AB617 work. Keep it in mind that we're looking at original boundaries or 7-mile boundaries. We're looking at emissions inventories. So with that, I mean, all that conversation, looking at how we could integrate this monitor into the 617 and how we could potentially integrate or even streamline the communication of samples.
Okay. Randy.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Could you say that? I'm not sure I understood the suggestion.
I think Gustavo just wants to basically see if we can take the monitoring and integrate it into what the committee is doing with 617. Anybody else on the committee? Any actionable items? Any thoughts? Okay. So let's just close this portion out, and let's just go ahead and give it to the public. If you could just identify yourself, and then if you have a comment or question.
I'll try and make this quick. I have a comment or two, observation, and some questions.
Yes,
I forgot. I should probably stand, but I can't hold my notes at the same time. I'm Vince Saragosa. I'm a Bakersfield resident. Okay, so it's kind of hard without a table. But on page 8 of your handout, were those 11 chemicals restricted? These are the 11 chemicals in Shafter. And I mean federally restricted, state restricted.
Yes, so I'm looking at the list. So starting at the top, MITC is restricted. 1,3-D is restricted. Methylbromide is restricted. Chlorpyrifos is restricted. I don't think any of the others are restricted.
Okay. On page 13, I think you've answered the question, but you mentioned the monitoring site, which is now at Sequoia. This is a community monitoring station. But there's a bullet point number 4, 4 consecutive 24-hour samples collected on all sampling sites. Are these the field sites that you guys are talking about that are short-term?
No, these are in 5 communities, I think?
Oh.
5 different communities.
So it's not necessarily Shafter.
Right. Okay, I see. Shafter is one of the communities.
Okay, cool. The other question or observation is, and I don't know the lady's name there on the right-hand side, but she mentioned something about notification. First of all, I spoke to Brian Leahy, the director, when he was here visiting Bakersfield during the Spray Safe, and he talked about the regulation notification of schools. And just wanted to let you know that is brand new, January 1st, and kudos to staff. And for folks who don't know, PER, Pesticide Use Reporting Database, is the most robust in the United States. There's a lot of data up there. It's really good information. So the regulation, as I recall, is underway. Basically, for those people that don't know, and you had mentioned it, that the new regulation prohibits pesticide applications within a quarter mile of public through K-12 schools and licensed child care facilities during school hours, Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. So just an observation. Observation is in Kern County, there's about 100 schools in Central Valley near ag production parcels. In the previous meetings here, we decided to have an area of interest, a 7-mile distance ring, and it was downtown Shafter all the way out. I believe, based on my analysis, there's 9 schools. Of the 9, 8 are elementary. I didn't look at child care, and 1 is high school. But the requirement is this: growers are to provide annual notification to public schools and licensed daycare facilities, as well as county ag commissioners, of the pesticide expected to be used within a quarter mile of these schools and facilities. Now, one of the things that I found interesting is that staff put together an annual notification form to be used or not to be used. But basically, they're saying the growers are supposed to identify the grower, makes sense, pesticide product name, registration number for pesticide, basically looking at active ingredients, and then to give 48 hours notice to the principals or daycare administrators. So the question I have, and it's kind of an interesting question, how is that being enforced, and what happens if school administrators are not being notified 48 hours in advance before the spray? Is there a penalty, or does somebody make a complaint? Are school principals here locally aware of this, as well as the school day child care administrators? And last but not least, in this 7-mile distance ring, which is the area of interest, in my opinion, one community monitoring site, air monitoring site, is insufficient. Sequoia School is in the northwest quadrant. If you look at the area of interest that the steering committee identified, there are schools in other quadrants. And based on the wind rows, it's not the same air. There's a different level because there's parcels, Ag Production Act parcels in the southwest corner, northeast corner quadrant of this circle. And you're only covering one quadrant and maybe to some degree the southwest. I think an actionable item is that we should be looking at multiple community air monitoring stations under AB 617. So I had a bunch of questions relating to that new regulation. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'll let people know here what's going on, because I think a lot of people don't realize that. But if the school sites are being notified, parents should just ask for the information from the principal. Go ahead.
Okay. So you got partially correct. So the regulation requires annual notification from the growers to the schools. That annual notification includes a list of pesticides expected to be used in the upcoming year. That notification goes to schools. It's up to the schools whether they want to disseminate it further to staff and parents. Okay. There is no requirement for a 48-hour notification except when there is a pesticide that a grower wants to use but it's not on the list he previously submitted. In that case, if it's a new pesticide, he wants to be able to use it but wasn't on the list, he must add it to the list and give that to the school at least 48 hours before he uses it. But it's the requirement is not for a 48-hour notification of every pesticide application.
Good evening. My name is Lupe Martinez. On that same issue that you were talking about, the annual notification, what does it do? Because it's given to the schools, but the schools don't know when the grower is going to spray. They don't know what time, what day, what month, any information other than in 365 days, we might spray one of these. So how does that help the families, the kids, and the parents to know what's going to be sprayed and when. So that is completely flawed. It is really, I don't understand what was the nature or why, what was the intention behind that, and it has nothing to really protect the children. So that's my first thing. And the other thing that I wanted to mention to you is about, earlier you talked about the pilot notification project within Kern. There isn't any. That was an intention at the, there was an intention a while back about trying to see if there could be cooperation between some growers and giving notification and setting that up. It didn't function. It was all voluntary. And so, yeah, there are some good growers. Some other growers are busy with their business. So it didn't happen. Just to let you know, I think you need to be more in contact with the agricultural commissioner. The other thing I do want to ask you is, did I hear that we've been collecting data for 28 years? Is that the case, that the data has been you started back then? And I'm not sure. Is that the case?
We've been monitoring for between DPR and the Air Resources Board, we've been monitoring for 1-3-D off and on since 1990.
Right. So that's about 28 years at this point. In 28 years, how many pesticides have been either banned, regulated, or out of the market at this point with all of that data that you have? Number one. Number two, in I heard you say that it's very labor intensive and it's $150,000 per year. Is that $150,000 per year for the last 28 years? So what do we have for that if that's the case? I don't know if it is. Then the next one is, what do we know about our children's health around the schools, sensitive places? Who is going to do any health studies to figure out if our children have been exposed? Are they ill? Are they contracting cancer? And who does that once you have all this information? And by when does that begin? When does it trigger these health studies, or is that something that's just information for everybody to know? It's good to know, but it's also good to take some action. The other thing is, we're talking about notification. Let me just go back to that. It's kind of strange because my phone will go off at the middle of the night, and it tells me that there's a torrential coming, or we're going to get flooded, or all these things are happening, or when there's a child abduction. So it doesn't seem like it's that complicated. Thank you.
Anyone else? Yes, John Haley, Bakersfield resident. And I don't know if maybe it's because I'm a novice, but personally I've been grateful for the education on the pesticide monitoring. I personally was impressed by everything that DPR is doing and the Farm Bureau or the Ag Commissioner is doing to monitor for pesticides. Thank you for everything you've been doing. And one thing I hear, and I, like I said, I'm not a grower, is, you know, you hear the term license applicator. What does it take to apply a pesticide? Do you have to have a license, or what does that take?
So a certificate is required if a person is going to be applying what we call a restricted material. In California, there are about 1,000 or more pesticides that can be used. About 36 of those are what we call restricted materials. Restricted materials are pesticides that have potential hazards to health or the environment, and they go through greater scrutiny in order to purchase and use them. And so one of the requirements is that a person has to pass an exam on pesticide safety in order to purchase and use a restricted material. Yeah, I wasn't sure. So, okay. So, let me see if I can remember all the questions. So, regarding the number of pesticides that have been banned in the last 20 years, 8 years, I'm sorry, I don't know off the top of my head. Okay. Thank you. what do we know about children's health around schools? At this point, it's probably pretty limited information. There have been some studies, particularly up in the Salinas area, where UC Berkeley is falling several hundred children since birth through, I think they're now in middle school, to see what their health is in relation to pesticide exposures. When our health study is triggered, there is no regulatory trigger for a health study. There is always considered on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. Is there anyone else that's got a comment or a question? Hold on, Lynette. No, go ahead, sir. Okay. Just your name and your...
My name is Cesar Aguirre, Bakersfield resident. I work with CCJN. I have a question and a suggestion. When it comes to the application near schools, I understand that there's a time limit, and regardless of the time limit, you said no application if people are nearby despite the time. And that's near schools, I understand, but just with a quick Google search, Hermosa, Planada, Lowen, Becker, Burns, Poplar, Handel, Elizabeth, these are all streets here in Shafter that have a field directly next to them, fence line. I think that there should be a record of applications near these areas, regardless of notification to residents or not, because that will help with things like what Lynette said. People have to be notified to show that it went off site. Creating these records of applications will show this record without having to put the burden of proof onto the victim and having to call every time there is an application, because that record will already exist. I understand that permits have to be, made for burning. So I'm sure we're not asking for permits. We're asking for a notification maybe within the same 48-hour window that will create a record that would help not only the ag commissioner, but other people when they need to trace down and find where these pesticides came from. And my question was, there was a lot going on, so I want to understand. If the samples that you take from the pesticides are averaged out per year, do you monitor that when there is no applications? And if so, why? I would assume that the most cost-effective way to monitor the effects of these applications or the exposure levels is when they're applied and not at random times when there may not be use of them. I understand there's about a three-month span when they're used. And if the majority of those random samples are made within the other 9 months, I feel like that's not representative of the time when it was being used at its most intense levels. Thank you.
Okay, so there was some statements and a couple questions. Go ahead, Randy.
I think if I got the question correctly. So we conduct three different types of monitoring. We conduct the application site monitoring and the seasonal monitoring, which is specifically meant to capture those high use periods and high applications, large applications. The air network is designed to give us long-term exposures over several years. And so we do collect samples year-round every week, and some of those weeks there will be applications that occur, other weeks that they won't. That said, different pesticides will have different peak use periods. And so just because we picked the peak use season for T-loam, for instance, it may be a different peak use season for chlorpyrifos. And so since we're monitoring for 31 pesticides simultaneously, it's infeasible for us to try to capture peak use for each of those at different times. So we just monitor year-round.
Okay. Anyone else? Lynette, did you have a comment?
So I was just going to mention about the notification requirement for Kern County. We do require a 48-hour notice of intent for any restricted material that requires a permit to be sent to our office. We're the only county in the state of California that enters in that information. We send it out to adjacent growers so that they can communicate with their neighbor the application, how they're going to apply it, the name of the product, and the date and time, so that they can coordinate field activities such as, you know, harvest or whatever they have to do. So it's a additional measure that we have put on our growers that no other county in the state of California has for restricted materials to try to communicate and not have incidents. So it's just something that we have done, and it is work, labor intensive on my staff, but it's worth it. It has seemed to help in incidents. So it seems to be working, but it's a lot of work, but we are doing it. And I don't know about the other counties or where that will go, but I'm just saying that's what we have done in Kern County.
Thank you, Lynette. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Aird, and our coalition works a lot with communities throughout Kern County, and including in Shafter. And so we really appreciate hearing about the monitoring that the Department of Pesticide Regulation is doing. But frankly, what we hear from community members is that they're more concerned about the controls and the actual regulations of pesticides to better protect community health. So in particular, looking at pesticides such as T-lone, which, as we noted before, was actually banned for 5 years when the levels of exposure were found to be even lower than what was just found in Shafter, and yet it's been a year, and to our knowledge, no real action has been taken to make sure that communities are protected. In addition, chlorpyrifos, which the US EPA scientists found, and the data is concurred with by the most recent DPR risk assessment, that there is no safe use of chlorpyrifos for young children between 1 and 2 ages, years old, and that's because of exposures from water, from food residues, and also from drift from a half mile away. And that's not a combination, that's any one of those particular exposures. So what we hear from community members is, what is the Department of Pesticide Regulation doing to actually protect children? And pregnant women are currently being exposed to chlorpyrifos in this county and in Shafter. 11 pounds of chlorpyrifos that a woman is exposed to while she's pregnant for every month that she's pregnant, when you add that up, it increases the likelihood that she's going to have a child born with autism spectrum disorder by 14%. So this is a real concern of community members, and I think the community is interested in hearing more about how the Department of Pesticide Regulation does work that's protective of human health and the environment, because that's part of your mandate.
My name is Paulina Torres. I'm with the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment. And just to be clear, I know it's the next agenda item. We're going to be talking about the Community Emission Reduction Program. I just want to clarify that this presentation was given today, right, so that we could include pesticides in the SERPs. I'm just thinking about moving forward. You know, these action items are, just to clarify, are these part of the SERPs? And so is DPR going to continuously be involved in the SERP development and along with the air districts? And
well,
just need some clarification.
Yeah, so look, Randy, so to answer that, absolutely pesticides will come under the umbrella of 617, but we don't have an action item other than what the committee member Gustavo has put down, and we'll be getting back on that issue, which is basically a mirror of what you just said.
Okay, great.
So, okay, is that it on from the public? So we've got 5 minutes.
Hi, sorry. Yana Garcia, not a public member, but Assistant Secretary for Environmental Justice and Tribal Affairs at CalEPA. I just want to thank everybody for the time that you've taken to be here and for this conversation. But also on the complaints and reporting app that we were talking about briefly, that's something that the agency is very much supporting, is very supportive of, that DPR is developing, and all of your feedback on that is very well taken, so thank you for that. Super interested to hear any other suggestions you have for what that might look like, to provide both reports to the state and also to be able to better provide notification to the public and to residents. And on the health-based data, that's another area where we'd be happy to provide additional support. Somebody mentioned the Office of Environmental Health Hazards Assessment. They are not here today, but we can certainly work with them to provide some information if that would be helpful on health metrics. So thanks.
Hi, I'm Julie Henderson. I'm Deputy Secretary for Health and Public Policy at CalEPA, and I just wanted to address your comments, Sarah. Thanks very much. Just to talk a little bit about DPR's proposed actions, both with respect to 1,3-D and chlorpyrifos. Randy mentioned that there is action being considered, and so one of the things that DPR is considering now and is planning to do is to look at a regulation that would address both the longer-term and short-term health effects of 1,3-D, so that should be coming in the near term. And on chlorpyrifos, as you may or may not know, it went through a process at the state scientific review panel. They recommended identifying chlorpyrifos as a toxic air contaminant. DPR did file a notice with the Office of Administrative Law to have chlorpyrifos listed as a toxic air contaminant. The Office of Administrative Law approved of that at the end of January, and that listing will become effective on April 1st. And so DPR will be coordinating with other agencies at Cal EPA, as well as with the local county ag commissioners, to identify additional control measures that are necessary to protect public health with respect to chlorpyrifos.
Okay. Well, it's 5 minutes till 8. Clearly, we're not going to get into the SERP tonight, but I would like to introduce Jessica Correa, who's a senior air quality specialist with the district, who's kind of giving you a little abbreviated version, and then we want to close it out, but clearly this agenda item will be moved to our April 8th meeting. Jessica?
Hi, everybody. So as Jimmy said, my name's Jessica Correa. I'm a senior air quality specialist with the Valley Air District. Firstly, I really want to thank DPR for being here for such a comprehensive presentation. I think all of us really learned a lot tonight. So I really loved, Gustavo, your question, and Paulina, your point. How are we going to implement these measures into the EB617 process? And the answer to that is through the SERP process. So what is a SERP? That's going to be our Community Emission Reduction Program, which is a plan for cleaning up the air quality in Shafter. I'm not going to have time to go through my whole presentation tonight, but I will be back next month to go over the different components of a SERP. We'll be presenting an outline to the committee for your review and comment. But tonight, I want to leave you with some questions to be thinking about. So hopefully we can bring these questions for discussion to the next meeting. So on page 12 of the presentation, you guys have either a copy of, there's copies in the back, or the presentation's also posted online. There's going to be a list of these questions that we would really appreciate your thoughts and comments on. So firstly is, as you go through that presentation, do you have any questions on the layout of the SERP, any recommendations for that? Secondly, what are the main sources of pollution that are a concern for the community? We talked about this back in December. We got a really great list, kind of a preliminary list of what the main concerns are from the community, but we want to hear about that. Like, has that changed? Any updated recommendations on that? Thirdly, ways to reduce pollution from these sources that you would like to see implemented or would like to learn more about. The Valley Air District, in partnership with agencies like DPR or the California Air Resources Board, has really comprehensive rules and regulations and other policies already in place. So, you know, maybe there's already a rule out there that's regulating a source. Do you want to learn more about that? Or is there something you have a suggestion to implement? Finally, emission reduction funding programs that you would like to receive more information about or see increased funding in the community. In just a second, we're going to hear from Todd DeYoung, who's one of our grants managers at the district. He's going to talk about an incentive program that we have in place already, and we can do a deep dive into what incentive programs we have, what we could possibly be implementing in the community to get targeted emission reductions here in Shafter. And then finally, beyond all that, what else do you as a committee or you as the public need to provide meaningful input on the SERP? What can we provide you? Let us know. We'll make our best efforts to be getting that information to you. So I'm going to really look forward to being back next month, going through a little bit more detailed presentation next month, as well as presenting an outline on the SERP. And with that, I will turn it over to Todd DeYoung, who's our grants manager.
Thank you, Jessica. Good evening again. My name is Todd DeYoung, Grants Program Manager. Just want to put in a very brief plug for the Air District's Tune In and Tune Up program. This is our voluntary vehicle repair and replacement program. I'd like to go into more details with you, but it is a weekend-based event where you bring your vehicles to generally a fairgrounds or an open lot. You have your vehicle tested. If it fails an emissions test, you're provided with a voucher for up to $500 in emissions-related repairs. Our next event, and that's why I'm announcing it here tonight, is next weekend on the 23rd at the Kern County Fairgrounds in Bakersfield. So hopefully some residents here in the area can make it down. And as an aside, we are looking to, for the work that we're doing here in Shafter, we're actually looking to potentially put on an event here in the city of Shafter for the residents of the area and the surrounding community so that we can get vehicles within the community to these events and get them repaired or replaced. Any questions? I'd be happy to talk to you after the meeting. All the information is available on our website at valleyair.org. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd. One last quick update. I'm John Klassen. I'm the Director of Strategies and Incentives at the Air District. A quick update. I was here last month talking about community air monitoring. Wanted to give you all an update that the PM2.5 analyzer that's running here in Shafter, we now have a way for you to view that data on our website. So if you go to valleyair.org, on the front page, you can click on the AB617 link. From there, you can go and select a view of the Shafter community webpage. From there, you can click air monitoring, and then it'll show you a graph of PM2.5 being monitored here in Shafter. You can click back in time to look back to early February when I first started looking at that analyzer running here in Shafter. Go back in time, look at that. It's going to be updated going forward every hour, so it's there for you to take a look at. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we've come to the end of our March meeting. I just want to make sure that, to the committee specifically, that the next agenda item on April 8th at 5:30 will be the continuation of the SERP. So we want to make sure that we have an understanding of that topic. Again, the PowerPoint is online or in the back to committee members and to the public. It'll give you 30 days to digest and come back with any questions that you might have. In addition, is there any comment from the committee regarding some actionable items that potentially we would like to address at the next meeting? Tom?
We heard from Air District staff, but I'm hoping that since this is a new program and new money, that we're not stuck just doing the same old programs just a little bit more, and that there can be new innovative air, you know, emission reduction programs that will come out of this committee. And I hope the Air District is willing to look at ideas for new programs and not just increase the tune in, whatever it is, here in Shafter. And not just keep giving farmers money for new tractors. We got to do a few new things around here because our air is not getting better very quickly. So new innovative ideas is what we're here for, not just the same old thing that hasn't worked.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Anyone else from the committee? Okay. So lastly, I would like to thank Randy and Edgar. I think their expectations were to be up here for about 45 minutes, but we do appreciate not only the Department of Pesticide Regulation. Thank you. Exactly. It's been a long day for everyone, and especially to the leadership at Cal EPA and DPR. We thank you for your time. Obviously, Shafter in the South Central Valley is very important to the entire state of California, and Tom's comments, we're looking for some innovative ideas. We look forward to seeing you at 5:30 on April 8th. Members, if you could leave your name badges and your table cards on the table before you leave, and we'll see you in April. Thank you.